Just a note to listeners, this episode contains frank discussions of child sexual abuse and workplace sexual harassment, and if that's not something that you would like to hear about, this is probably not the episode for you.
Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 5 of Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history. My name's Hugh Lemmy, I'm a writer, author, and artist.
And I'm Ben Miller, a writer, researcher, and member of the board of the Schwules Museum in Berlin.
So last week we discussed Elagabalus, the Roman god-king emperor, who drowned his dinner companions in a sea of rose petals, supposedly. Who are we talking about this week, Ben?
Well, Hugh, many people at this point may have seen the Netflix film Maestro, which is a biopic about the American conductor Leonard Bernstein. The film tells the story of the dashing conductor and composer who was born into a Jewish American family in the Boston suburbs, became a brilliantly talented young musician in New York, lived an essentially openly gay life there in the 1940s, but was pressured to settle down in order to arrive at the commanding heights of the musical profession, who fell in love with and married the actress Felicia Montealegre, had three children, led the New York Philharmonic, continued to engage in gay affairs, and passed away from emphysema. He was a chain smoker in the early 1990s. And Bernstein was, above all, a great communicator. His audience was the public, even when he was conducting. There's a moment in the film, if people have seen it, when Bradley Cooper as Bernstein is conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in the ecstatic conclusion of Gustav Mahler's Second Symphony. And the symphony is entitled Resurrection. And this moment is the moment when the resurrection is being musically depicted. You have blaring horns, two singer soloists and a vast choir all singing at the top of their lungs, a 100-piece symphony orchestra, every instrument playing as loud as possible. And Cooper's Bernstein is jumping and lunging and twisting into contortions, and sweat is falling off of his brow. And you might think it's all a little bit much, but if you go and actually find the video of Bernstein conducting this music, it's based on, if anything, Cooper is somewhat playing it down. Bernstein was handsome. He was a very compelling lecturer. For example, he delivered the Norton Lectures at Harvard. It was sort of a series of reflections on the global history of music, and I recommend those if anyone's interested in some great Leonard Bernstein content. They're on YouTube. And Bernstein loved publicity, and he loved the spotlight. He loved speaking directly to people, and those podium acrobatics were part of this kind of vast exhibitionist extroversion that characterized his entire life. But the next most famous gay Jewish conductor of the 20th century was, in a lot of ways, Bernstein's opposite. Neither particularly handsome nor particularly extroverted, he made his musical mark not as a flamboyant podium acrobat or a great public communicator, but a musician's musician. In a documentary made about him in the mid-2000s, the conductor James Levine leads the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra into the resounding final movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and he stops the rehearsal and looks at them and says, "Don't make me do this." And as he says this, he mimes this big, huge gesture. And he says, "If you make me do that, then the audience is going to moderate its response to the music to what they see. And if you can get there to the full extent of where we need to be without me doing this big thing, the impact will actually be more, not less."
For listeners, Ben is making a sort of double-fisted hand gesture in the air, sort of.
Yeah. Short instead of tall, overweight, his face framed in a halo of frizzy hair, James Levine ruled the Metropolitan Opera from his first engagement there in 1972 until he was fired in disgrace in 2017 after what were commonly referred to in the press as, quote, allegations of sexual misconduct. And they came to spectacular light in the New York Post and the New York Times. I want to stop here and talk about the phrase sexual misconduct and how much I hate it. The Me Too movement is extraordinarily necessary and important, but sexual misconduct, as this now common phrase, is, I think, one of its worst legacies. And the reason I hate this phrase is because it doesn't mean anything, right? What is the misconduct and to whom? And it takes us, I think, from a conversation about rape, about assault, about patriarchy, about power, into a conversation about misconduct, which I think is a weasel word that ends up creating moral equivalence between harassing dozens of employees and having an affair.
Mm-hmm.
And it also puts the onus on sex, rather than understanding sex as one of a lot of sites where dysfunctional and violent power relationships can play out. And I think that's how we end up with people who are more scared of sex scenes on TV than bosses who can fire complainants at will. And I also think that sexual misconduct as a phrase downplays the severity of harassment, of assault, of rape, while turning consensual adult and private behavior into grounds for public comment and debate, which it doesn't need to be. And I think the language ends up conflating a bunch of things that shouldn't be conflated, and we need better language. And this is important because what James Levine did needs a more precise description than sexual misconduct. 9 men came forward to allege sexual abuse by Levine over a period between the late 1960s and the mid-1990s, some of those men alleging that the abuse began while they were still children. There was a pattern to these men's stories. Most of them met Levine as children or young teenagers. Some of them met him as junior employees at institutions that he ran. All of them saw him as a musical mentor, and in every case, he groomed them, mentored them, became close to them, and then initiated unwanted sexual conduct. And these allegations, Hugh, were the classical music industry's worst-kept secret for the entire time this was going on. These were joked about in opera blogs. They were joked about in zines. They were alluded to in interviews with Levine in the New York Times and the New Yorker. And they circulated so widely that when I was 12 years old and James Levine was named music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, where my father was a cellist in the section, my parents sat me down and told me about this.
Wow.
And at that time, I was often backstage at the Boston Symphony or at summer home Tanglewood and hanging out with friends who were also the children of BSO players. And like, we were joking about this openly as kids. And yet for years, these allegations were never investigated by the institutions that employed him. So really, this is a story, I think, about an extremely brilliant and talented musician who is also a profoundly abusive person, and who really left a sort of horrible trail of bodies in his wake, but also about institutions that, you know, I have to be careful how I phrase this, but, you know, yeah, let's just leave it there. So James Lawrence Levine was born into a musical family in Cincinnati, Ohio in June of 1943, and he came from a long line of musicians. His maternal grandfather was a synagogue cantor, and his father had a swing dance band. And starting from the age of 2, he was able to get up in the morning and play on the piano the bedtime songs his parents had sung him the night before.
Wow.
And so his mother taught him piano until the age of 6, when she told New York Magazine in 2006, quote, got better than I was. And at 10, he made his professional debut playing a Mendelssohn piano concerto with the Cincinnati Symphony.
He was a prodigy.
Absolutely a prodigy from a very, very young age, and seemed to have been interested in very little else. He was really just a complete musical person. He was shipped off to Juilliard, and he studied chamber music and theory with the LaSalle Quartet, which was led by the violinist Walter Levine. Levine had been born in Berlin and was one of many European musicians who, whether because like him they were Jewish and forced out, or whether because after the war they were offered higher salaries paid in the very powerful U.S. dollar, had moved to the United States in the mid-20th century in order to work there. And these musicians moved the center of gravity of the musical world to the United States for the first time. This is a time when money was pouring into music education, pouring into orchestras, and the middle and even working classes were flocking to symphonies and operas. Especially in New York, the Metropolitan Opera was, for example, a huge site for like the Italian-American immigrant community, among others. And Walter Levine had a long association with the musicians and the music of the Second Viennese School, which is an avant-garde atonal musical tradition that emerged in the German-speaking world in the 1920s. And this rigorous musical tradition was passed on to Levine, and he went everywhere a promising young musician was supposed to go, including the Marlborough Festival in the summers in Vermont, where young musicians still go and study for free with older masters. In 1964, so at 21, he began his training as a conductor by apprenticing with George Zell, who was then music director of the Cleveland Orchestra. And Zell was born in Budapest, raised in Vienna, and his conducting teacher was the composer Richard Strauss in Berlin. And Strauss once summarized his conducting rules, and they included the following. 1, remember that you are making music not to amuse yourself, but to delight your audience. 2, you should not perspire when conducting. 3, never look encouragingly at the brass. 4. But never let the horns and woodwinds out of your sight. If you can hear them at all, they are still too strong. 5. If you think the brass is blowing hard enough, tone it down another shade or two. 6. It is not enough that you yourself should hear every word the singer sings. You should know it by heart anyway. The audience must be able to follow without effort. If they do not understand the words, they will go to sleep. 7. Always accompany the singer in such a way that he can sing without effort. So this was the Zell training, and this became the Levine training, right? And this is a modest and extremely self-effacing style of conducting, not one focused on expressing emotion, but instead on rhythmic discipline, on musical transparency, on balance, on architecture. If you think about a complex musical score, like that end of that Mahler piece with hundreds of different musical lines as a layer cake, in this ideal of music making, you should always be able to perceive every layer of the cake.
Okay.
And to bring it back, yeah, so if a Bernstein-style conductor is standing in front of the orchestra at that moment and is really focused on resurrection and Sturm und Drang, a Zell-style conductor is thinking about whether the part of the harmonic argument that's in the mid-strings isn't being drowned out by the brass.
Okay.
And I want to make it clear here that at least artistically, I'm not a neutral observer, right? To me, as a lover of music, this Zell style of conducting and this sort of way of approaching it is artistically superior.
Okay.
So Levine made his professional conducting debuts at this time, including an important debut with the Chicago Symphony in 1971. And at this time, he starts becoming really one of the most prominent young conductors in the country. And he signs with this manager named Ron Wilford, who was sort of the guy behind the throne for many of the most powerful maestros in the country. These managers became extremely powerful as organizations started to plan earlier and earlier and to be more reliant on stars, because someone like Ron Wilford could say, well, if you want so-and-so, then you have to take so-and-so. And so, you know, they really sort of push their clients and you know, there were jokes that, you know, the orchestras didn't choose their music directors, Ron Wilford did. But it was also at about this time that Levine began to develop a personality cult. So while he was working as Zell's assistant, he founded an orchestra of students at the nearby Cleveland Institute of Music, and this was called the University Circle Orchestra. And he wasn't much older than the people in it, but he's already a prominent, famous musician, right? And most of these people are music students. And at the core of this group was a circle called the Levineites, who were 20 or so followers who actually dressed like him. So there's a uniform of velour shirts and desert boots, and they were supposed to completely limit their socialization with anyone other than one another and him. And Levine cultivated loyalty through very effusive praise and then would often just very cruelly drop someone who lost his favor. There was a Boston Globe article about this when after everything came to light. And someone who was in this said, quote, "So they're in a tough spot because this God that they thought were wonderful didn't think so anymore. At that point, they'd show up at rehearsal white as a sheet with blank faces. They just sort of stumble around for a while. Those were the kids that ended up as part of this group," end quote. So Levine would use his connections to bring very famous soloists and singers to perform with the University Circle Orchestra. But he also used his power at this point for much darker things. So Alan Ellsworth was an 18-year-old freshman violinist who was once called in to work on a Beethoven sonata with Levine, who told him to put the violin away and then started asking him about first mathematics, then his favorite authors, and then his masturbation habits and sexual preferences. Chris Brown was a double bass player who was 17 years old in the summer of 1968 and was a student at the Meadowbrook School of Music, where Levine was conducting the orchestra that summer. Levine demanded the two have sex, I don't know quite how to phrase this, but gave him an unwanted handjob. And then when Brown refused to return the favor, Levine just refused to speak to him for the entire rest of the summer, completely iced him out, didn't talk to him in rehearsals.
Classic grooming techniques.
Exactly. And so rumors began to spread about this group and the fact that it was a kind of sex cult, because it was turning into a sex cult. So the Levineites were often called over to Levine's house at 11 o'clock at night, and they were required to stay into the early hours of the morning. A violinist named Albin Ifish recalled to the Boston Globe that these evenings would devolve from music making into something else. So, quote, "We'd have a mutual masturbation session where we'd have to blindfold ourselves and pair off in twos. The test for us would be, can you tell if it's a girl or a guy?" End quote. Ifish had met Levine at Meadowbrook when he was 20. He visited Levine's room to discuss a problem he was having with his bow arm, and Levine said, quote, "If we're going to work on your violin, I have to understand you sexually," end quote.
Jesus Christ.
And Levine would justify this conduct by saying he was trying to make them better musicians by helping them overcome sexual hang-ups and helping them learn sort of discipline, body discipline and self-control. Ifish said, quote, "It was your job, basically, to service him under the guise of improving your music playing," end quote. And it also extended into psychological games. So Levine once asked Ifish, quote, "If you could save just one person, who would it be, me or your mother? And if you pick your mother, you're going to walk out this door and never see me again. But if you pick me, you're going to close the door, step into this house and be with me forever."
Jesus Christ.
When Ifish...
It's like a cartoonish level of evil. It's
when really Ifish attended his sister's wedding, he recalled that Levine had the group hold him down so that Levine could tickle him for half an hour.
So weird.
It's really weird. Quote, "A big thing was tickling you for a long time, half an hour or more. Those were usually the days when Levine would take you home that night. He felt it would uninhibit you." And sometimes it got even worse. So the cellist James Lestock recalled a moment in 1972 when Levine, quote, "asked me to take my clothes off and he started pinching me in the groin. The emotional and physical pain got so great, I didn't know why he was hurting me," end quote. Lestock actually started to cry, but Levine did not stop. And so the idea behind all of this was that the Levineites were going to form the core of an orchestra that was going to be called, wait for this, the God Philharmonic, which would play music without any limitations and live and work together in perfect harmony.
It is a cult.
It is a cult. But the idea was disrupted when, in 1972, Levine was named principal conductor of the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Some of the group moved to New York to be with him. Some of them joined the orchestra, some other professional ensembles there, but that whole sort of thing started to fall apart. Now, when Levine arrived at the Met, the institution was in disarray. The orchestra especially had faded from its mid-century glory days, and so his first years at the institution were occupied with both building the orchestra and building his own power. And it's become more and more common, especially in the last 30 years, this trend was already beginning when Levine started at the Met, for conductors to have more than one music directorship. And so, you know, they're... being the principal conductor or the music director of an orchestra means that you're there for 8 to 10 subscription weeks, but you're not which is actually not that much if it's a 22-week season, right?
Sorry, you're going to have to break it down for someone like me who has no concept of classical music. What's a musical director and what's a composer?
Principal conductor. So the conductor is the guy at the front with the baton. And a principal conductor or a music director is someone who is exactly how it sounds, like the main conductor of an orchestra. And a music directorship usually carries with it additional responsibilities than just principal conductor. So if you're a music director, that means that you're also working on programming. It means that you're also probably sitting in on auditions. And like auditions are done by committee, as anyone who's seen the movie Tar can tell you. But you're sort of deciding what's going to be programmed. At an opera house, there's a whole other level of responsibility because you're also helping cast, right? So you're figuring out, okay, so next year we want to do these pieces. Who can we put in them? But if you think about how complicated it is to cast opera at a high level, if you're casting something at the Met, there's 4 or 5 principals, and those all have to be the right people.
These are the
principal singers. And so you have to figure out, okay, what do we want to do? Who can we engage when, right? And how do we kind of put this puzzle together of figuring out, like, whether we do this Mozart or that Mozart, because it depends. Then we need this many baritones or that many baritones, but we want this singer for that piece. But if we hire her, her manager says that we have to hire this new person when we have to find something for her to do.
Okay.
Like it's very common. And this all happens 5 years out.
And so they're managing around people's schedules because it's this singer who's going to come and do whatever this Mozart thing also wants to do something in Italy with another orchestra.
Exactly. And also, what does she want to do and what does she feel like doing? And also predicting over the course of a singer's career, voices change, right? So 5 years from now, you might be casting someone in something that they've never done before, but you're trusting that you hear this happening. Like it's an extremely highly skilled thing. And then in addition to that, you're also, as you prepare each piece of music, ideally, you are also slowly building up the orchestra in a certain artistic direction so that through years of playing together, the orchestra's playing overall will change, improve as you add new players, as they play together more, as you work with them more, as a conductor kind of works towards their ideal sound, right? And so it's a big job, and it's a complicated job. And he really threw himself into it. Like, he was someone who, when he was at the Met and when he was healthy, was working all the time, was in the building all the time. And at the beginning, he was working in collaboration with the English director, John Dexter. And with Dexter, he mounted a whole series of new productions. He brought a bunch of pieces to the Met that had never been done there, including the opera Lulu by Alban Berg, which is one of the sort of 20s Second Viennese School opera, is one of the most complicated and brilliant pieces of the 20th century. And he also started the television broadcasts of the Met in the late 70s. And he also got a recording contract for the Met with Deutsche Grammophon, which is who you want to be with if you're in classical music. And he spent his summers mostly either at the Ravinia Festival or the Salzburg Festival, which is the sort of prominent classical music festival in Austria.
So you're already getting a perfect storm for someone to take advantage of it as an abuser, which is they have this sort of prodigious natural musical talent. They have an organizational talent as well. And then they also have this like sort of power over people's careers and lives.
An extremely direct power over people's careers and lives, because the orchestras are unionized, right? So orchestra musicians have a fair degree of recourse. Doesn't mean that it's impossible for a conductor to abuse the orchestra, but over the course of the 20th century, orchestra musicians really kind of organized themselves out of all kinds of workplace abuse. In fact, mostly just kind of tyranny. I mean, it was common in the early 20th century for conductors to scream at orchestras or to have temper tantrums or to demand that everyone stay there and just work as long as possible until it was right. And, you know, orchestras go union in the 20th century, and all of a sudden there's overtime and regulations, and you can't yell at people anymore.
And it's a very secure job, right?
It has been, yes. However, this was also accompanied by an overall reduction in the amount of work.
Okay.
So if you think about in the 50s in the US, you know, every movie studio, so there's 10 studios in Hollywood, they each had a full symphony orchestra.
Okay.
There was more work out there, and there were fewer people trying to do it than there are now. However, the jobs that do exist now are quite secure when you get them.
Yeah, because I was listening to this podcast about, and please don't laugh at me for being déclassé on this, but about Phantom of the Opera, which has run for like, I don't know, 30 years or something.
Yeah.
And they were interviewing the orchestra there. And there were people there who had been there since day one.
Oh, yeah.
And once they were in, they were in.
Broadway is the other place where, other than classical music, at least in the US, where union musicians and like union orchestras are still like a sort of powerful force.
Yeah. But then this was amazing because like, for 30 years, these people had played the same score every day, eight times a week.
I mean, that's really, in fact, that was whenever my dad would complain about being in the Boston Symphony, we would like joke that, you know, you could be doing that, because that's much more brutal, actually, because that is literally the same thing every night, where at least at the Met, you have fewer performances. Many of them are longer, right? You know, the Phantom of the Opera is not 6 hours of Götterdämmerung, but at least at in the Met, you're playing different music every night.
Yeah.
Right. So Levine's musical style continued to be based on this very kind of careful, thoughtful study rather than sort of dramatic interpretation. And there's this, I think, really telling moment when he's in an interview with New York Magazine in 2006, and the interviewer is trying to get good quote. The interviewer is trying to ask a bunch of like interview style questions, and, you know, tell me about this, tell me about that. And Levine keeps stopping him and going back to a conversation about the meaning of fermatas, which are breaks that interrupt the flow of the music, in 1 20-second section of an aria in a Mozart opera.
Okay.
So the guy's like, but what about, how do you reflect on your this and that? Levine's like, no, but if you think about in this aria right here, at that pause, what does that mean? Right? Like, it's a very, very careful thinking and work. And there's a quote of Levine's, which I think is true, and he said, quote, "The farther we get from the living tradition of opera, the more difficult it is to come up with the voices and personalities to perform it convincingly." And this is something that's happening, right? The reasons why this happens are complicated. Maybe we can talk about it in the Q&A, but the repertoire stops renewing itself in the early 20th century. So after the 1920s, new pieces that are actually performed often just start making up less and less and less of the repertoire, and more both symphony orchestras and opera houses are playing what is an increasingly fixed canon of work.
Okay.
From basically Bach in the 1650s to the 1920s, Puccini, the death of Puccini in 25.
Okay.
And the further you get away, as Levine says, from this work as a living tradition, the more difficult a lot of things become, right? You're kind of, you're in a world where everything is about interpretation. You're in a world where these art forms are no longer living in some way. And you're in a world where knowledge about how to do things becomes extremely lineage based. And I think this is part of how he was able to build and hold power. And you have to say he was good at his job. Singers loved working with him. I mean, there's many, many singers who would talk about how he would understand exactly how to breathe with you. So if there was something that was difficult, you would just feel completely secure and know that he had it and you were there and he was there with you and you would do your best work with him there.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, the Metropolitan Opera is run by a board of directors, which is made up of a collection of unbelievably wealthy oligarchs, right? Oil money, finance money, dirty, 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 dirty money. And the job of this board of directors is to bring in the vast and unbelievable sums of money that are required to present grand opera without public subsidy, like hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Now, the Metropolitan Opera Board received a first report of Levine's abusive behavior in 1979.
Okay.
And this was an anonymous letter. And the house's director at the time, Anthony Bliss, actually responded to it. And he called them, quote, "scurrilous rumors that have been circulating for some months, often accompanied by other charges which we know for a fact are untrue," end quote. And the Met sat by for the following decades while Levine, alongside his work building the Met's orchestra into one of the finest operatic ensembles in history, also used the Met as a harem. An eventual internal investigation found a 20-year timeline of at least 5 cases of sexual harassment or assault at the Met from the mid-1970s until 1999. And behavior included asking a 16-year-old boy who was auditioning for him about his sex life, touching him inappropriately, and making sexual comments 7 times over the next 12 years. It included demanding and receiving sex acts from a musician in the orchestra. It included groping a young singer in a car after an audition before putting him in the Met's Young Artist Program, which has launched a lot of prominent careers. It included the childhood sexual abuse of a 16-year-old boy in the summer of 1986, followed up by a $50,000 payoff. And it included invitations to watch the maestro masturbate backstage and invitations to sexual activity to someone else in the Young Artist Program in the late 90s. So some of these men were in their mid-teens when the abuse began. Others were in their 20s. Levine doesn't seem to have been solely a pedophile, but he certainly was someone who systematically abused his power over younger musicians, right? Uh-huh. These people were always younger, and the age seems to have topped out in the mid-20s, right? Okay. It's like mid-teens to mid-20s.
Just partly also about ease of abuse. And
yes, and also about who, like at what age are musicians particularly, classical musicians especially, particularly dependent on mentorship.
Okay.
And it is, because it is such a lineage-based practice, it's a place where direct mentorship and being sort of promoted by someone older are not only welcomed, but in fact essential to making careers, right?
Okay.
People enter this world because they are the right person's assistant, followed by being the right person's trainee, followed by having the right person introduce them to their manager, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Like, think about how Levine comes from Gel.
Yeah.
And Gel comes from, right? So it's all, you know. So in 1987, reports again began to sort of swirl that Levine was about to resign from the Met. The New York Times referred to, quote, rumors about his private life. And at that time, he changed his title from artistic director to music director, and he presented a united front to the Times with the new general manager of the Met, Bruce Crawford. He said, quote, "This is nothing new for me. 10 years ago, Tony Bliss called me about reports of a morals charge in Pittsburgh or Hawaii or Dallas. Both my friends and my enemies checked it out, and to this day, I don't have the faintest idea where those rumors come from or what purpose they serve. Ron Wilford," again the manager, "says it's because people can't believe the real story, that I'm too good to be true." "Look," he said, "I'm not a doctor married with three children living in suburbia. I live my life openly. I don't make pretenses of this or that. What there is completely apparent. So if people want to damage me, they have to invent things that are lurid and vicious," end quote. And I think what was going on here was a really clever piece of media manipulation. These rumors are circulating in the business, and I think Levine was extremely cynically playing to fears about sex panic shared by a lot of arts journalists who themselves happened to be gay, right? I think it was easy, if you didn't actually know what was going on, to assume that the rumors might have originated with the homophobia of conservative donors, yeah. Right? Maybe Levine lived an unconventional life. Maybe he dated younger men in their 20s and some gossips adjusted the age down, right? I think Levine also looked like, you know, certain stereotypes of what a sex offender might look like, which aren't true, right? But yeah, I think that also kind of played into the extent to which you could kind of see how these rumors spread, but also understand how a lot of people might make it their business to not know, right? And what was interesting was that Levine, so there's that thing, that quote, like, I'm not a doctor married with three children in suburbia. I live my life openly. In a way, it sounds like he's saying, look, I'm openly gay. Mm-hmm. But still, in the 2006 New York Magazine profile, Levine is described as living with a friend, the oba player Sue Thompson, in his large apartment on Central Park West. And they did live together. They were seemingly roommates, but in 2001, in The New Yorker, the chief music journalist of The New Yorker, who is gay and a very brilliant writer, his name is Alex Ross, reviewed a book about the Met by Johanna Fiedler. And in the book, Fiedler discussed the industry gossip about Levine, and she called it malicious rumor and fact-free and made up. And Ross agreed with her. He said the rumors, quote, "belong in the category of personalized urban legends that attach themselves to certain celebrities for no discernible reason. His most effective response has been his performances, which make all the gossip sound bitter and small," end quote. And I'm not including this quote to shame Ross, who has since apologized for writing it, since everything came to light. But I'm including it because I actually made the same conclusions, right? And I happen to know that a lot of journalists had files going on this story because of the rumors, several. And no one was able to break the story until 2017. So I don't want people to walk away from this story thinking that the New York Times or the New Yorker was sitting on this story. Like, I don't think it's journalists' fault that it went on so long, but I think it's institutions like the Metropolitan Opera that never bothered to investigate, even though A, the rumors are circulating, and B, they actually got a real report. So when Levine took over the Boston Symphony in the early 2000s, I was just old enough to start going to concerts on my own, and my thinking about orchestral music, right, the way that it sounds right when I hear it in my head, was really shaped by James Levine, by the way that he set up programs, by the way he interpreted it. And like a lot of queer people who have a political and a cultural and a personal interest in defending non-normative sexual behavior between consenting adults, I fear sex panic and its consequences. And again, as I said, I think Levine was cynically playing to those fears by begging for privacy in interviews, by talking about being good, right? It must be said that in addition to the sexual abuse, Levine was also apparently a complete megalomaniac. So he traveled with his entourage. The entourage included a sort of group of assistants and doyens and managers, and also his brother, who was also gay, who was an artist, who also was allegedly involved in managing a lot of what we've been discussing, you know, which I think is a really fascinating and fucked up, like, brother relationship. He was also apparently a complete megalomaniac. There's reports that one time he had a temper tantrum in a record store because they didn't put out, like, his cutout next to his record bigger than other people's. There's a story that conductor Kenneth Woods tells about Levine having to review tape for which of four concerts was going to go out on the radio, right? Like, the mics are there for all the concerts, and he decides which one is the, like, mm-hmm. for the radio broadcast. And so the engineer came in and said, okay, what do you want to do? But instead of being able to just say to Levine, okay, what do you want to do? And Levine says, okay, so for the Beethoven, we'll use the first 10 minutes from Friday, but then can you bring in for the second part, can you bring in Saturday? I think that was better, and then go back to Friday. And then for the other one, Thursday was good.
Yeah.
He made the person ask the manager. They're all in the same room. Say to the manager, what does Maestro want? And the manager turns to him and says, what do you want? He says, we'll do this. The guy says, turns to him and says, we'll do this and this and this and this.
What?
Right? Like, it's crazy.
Like, you can't address him directly.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, the case that finally broke the story was broken by the New York Post in December of 2017. And I think it's interesting, the story didn't break until Levine was no longer of use to these institutions.
Hmm.
His health had long begun to fail. So his career at the Boston Symphony was cut short in spring of 2011, where he was forced to resign after an escalating series of cancellations due to failing health. After spring of 2011, he had a several-year absence from the podium while recovering from various spinal surgeries. And he ended up then returning to conduct in a wheelchair in 2013. And was doing sort of less and less. And finally, at the beginning of the 2017 season, he gave up his music directorship of the Met for the first time since the 1970s. And while all this was going on, we should think about how much money he was making. And I'm often someone who points to the fact that classical music is not just an oligarch-driven thing for very wealthy people, but I'm not going to help myself by describing his contract here. So in his 2019-9 contract, he got a $700,000 annual salary. He got a $50,000 a year, quote, travel and entertainment fee, end quote.
Wow.
And that's more than what most musicians make in a year, right? He got a $500,000 signing bonus. And that salary did not include the performances. So on top of that, he was paid per performance $10,000 more than whatever the singer being paid the most made.
And how much would a singer make in that scenario?
So the top nightly wage at the Met is $70,000 a night. So he's making $27,000 a night.
And how many nights does he play? What do you play?
I mean, when the contract was signed, many, like dozens, hundreds. So we're talking, it's millions a year.
Yeah.
It's millions a year.
Wow.
Now, when I tell you that a singer makes $17,000 a night, if they do five performances of something, that involves them also being there for 4 weeks of rehearsal. They're paying for their own travel. They're paying for their own housing. So it is a lot, right, at the top. But
so it's like $100,000 for those five performances. But then how many of those will they do a year?
Maybe six or seven runs, but that's at the very top level. It's the very top level people, right? Your Renee Flemings, your Pavarottis.
They're obviously doing like half a million or something.
Yeah. They're obviously doing extremely well.
Yeah.
Right. Even after you factor out all of the other stuff, you know, the people who are singing secondary parts and maybe are making 5,000 a night,
mm-hmm.
right? Suddenly 5,000 a night. So 25,000 to live in New York City on your own for 2 months. And you have to fly there and you have to get everything. Like, suddenly it starts being less. Like, so it, you know. But at the top of this industry, there's a huge amount of money. Now, as emeritus music director, where he wasn't managing the program anymore, he wasn't managing the Young Artist Program, anything, his annual compensation was cut to $400,000, but he still got his $27,000 per performance fee. And that per performance fee is 1/5 the starting salary of the orchestra. And it's higher than the annual wage of a lot of freelance musicians in New York.
Yeah.
The general manager of the Met, who's now Peter Gelb, as of the last available financial reports, makes $2 million a year, which is difficult to understand why. At least when Levine was healthy, he was there all the time and working hard, but no one should make that much money and no one should have this much power. So it was in 2017 that the New York Post broke its story. And initially, the Post did not reveal the name of the survivor it was talking about, but the person later came forward and named himself in connection with that story. So we can say that the person's name is Ashok Pai. And Pai met Levine in the early 1970s when he was 4 years old. And according to a 2016 police report, Levine, quote, took an interest in him. And in his teens, Levine began to abuse him. Levine once apparently told him in a car, quote, I want to see if you can be raised special like me, end quote. And the sexual abuse began at the age of 16, and Pai alleges hundreds of incidents following over the next years, continuing until 1993, when Pai was 23 years old. And Pai alleged that Levine's brother, who was part of his entourage, was, quote, in on the game. And these allegations and the timeline and the $50,000 in payoffs, they match the stories of one of the survivors in the Metropolitan Opera's internal report. No charges were actually brought. So Pai ended up filing a police report in 2016. And just after this came to light, the relevant police department in Illinois announced it was not going to bring charges because at the time the acts occurred, the age of consent was 16. So no crime was actually committed. But listeners can decide about the ethics of this behavior. I know what I think.
Yep.
Right. And this was also the time when the Levinites' stories of the sort of cult in the 70s, when this all began to drop, right? So when it all came out. So when the story broke, the Met stated that it was, quote, deeply disturbed by the news articles published about James Levine and suspended him pending an internal investigation. That investigation culminated with his dismissal in March of 2018. The Boston Symphony Orchestra put out an unbelievably carefully written statement which says that no one approached management, quote, during Levine's tenure with the BSO from 2004 to 2011, end quote, with any reports. Now, I suppose that it's possible that we, the teenage children of orchestra members, were joking with each other about James Levine while administrators had never heard anything. I guess it's also possible that in 1979, the Met did a deep and probing investigation of the reports that it had received, that, you know, no one noticed, no one decided to investigate. Maybe they did, maybe they found nothing. If we're going to evaluate the plausibility of that theory, we should note that the Met first learned of the police report that broke the story a year before the Post broke the story. And even after getting that police report, and even in the context of the rumors of the previous incident in 79, they did no internal investigation, they made no public announcement, they gave Levine an honorary title, and they kept engaging him for performances. And gossip should not be enough to end a career, right?
Yeah.
But gossip that is this persistent and that also included documented reports to management.
I was going to say it's not gossip at that point.
Right. Okay. But in 1979 and 2016, right, they should have triggered investigations that were far more serious than anything that seems to have occurred, right? As soon as they did their internal investigation, they found 9 cases, right? And there are still, or there were still, when it happened, there were people whose immediate response was to decry Levine's suspension from the Met. So one Twitter user wrote the day that the story broke. The story broke the morning after Levine had conducted a performance of the Verdi Requiem. And the Twitter user wrote, quote, right on the heels of that magnificent Verdi Requiem, could you not hold off on this cruel public statement until after a fair hearing? End quote. No one wants to think that an artist who has moved them deeply could have also used his enormous power to hurt people, right? The current music director of the Boston Symphony ended up at one point saying publicly that sexual harassment was not common in classical music because, quote, art makes people better humans, end quote.
Oh, fucking hell.
And I think this is part of a narrative of genius in which beautiful sounds can't be made by ugly people. And I think, if anything, we need to kill that narrative dead. Now, Levine actually sued the Met after being fired. Talk about chutzpah, right? Yeah. Which is what prompted that internal investigation to be released in court documents. And he claimed the whole thing was a conspiracy to get him out of his job because he was old and not telegenic. And later documents reveal that he actually got a $3.5 million settlement from the Met after his firing. And the speculation is probably that it's because his contract didn't have a morals clause and he was not found guilty of a crime.
Okay, yeah. But it doesn't have a morals clause, but surely there's still stuff around a behavior while he's in his role.
Okay, I want to make it clear that I don't know anything about what these conversations were. However, I think it's certainly possible to believe that if you were in Levine's position and you had nothing to lose and you knew what had been going on and you knew that these people had known, that you might be willing to say things publicly which would cause the Met to want to settle with you, possibly.
Okay. Right. So as a theoretical, and I'm not saying this is what happened, but as a theoretical, for example, you saying like, well, if you don't give me this payoff, then when it all comes out, I'll tell them that you knew.
Right.
I'll tell the press that you knew.
Now, I don't know if that's what happened, but one could imagine that happening. Now, during the Joe Orton and Kenneth Halliwell episode, right, we talked about the importance of separating the art from the artist, not because we want to preserve the idea of the perfect artist, but because we need to understand that people can make beautiful art while treating other human beings horribly. And it was precisely this knowledge that failed, right, in this case. Classical music's culture in which a certain kind of interpretive genius is valued above many other things, right, in which people with that genius are cushioned from the effects of their actions, where organizations have made themselves more and more reliant on big donors and sort of branded stars. This culture decided that James Levine's artistic contribution was more important than the health and safety of children and young adults and young musicians. And people like James Levine get fetishized for their interpretive genius. Systems are constructed to protect them, to enable them, and they're justified by talking about their gift and their potential and the beauty they bring into the world. But none of that accounts for the experiences of their victims or for the potential that might have been lost, right? And the cult of interpretive genius in which a single man can become to be seen as so gifted and important that institutions will protect him for 40 years is, I think, connected to a view of sexual abuse that sees perpetrators as, like, pervy predators rather than as the rather predictable outcomes of this kind of accumulation of power. And I think in order to make and hear art in healthy ways and to think sex in healthy ways, we have to destroy and replace the star system and the unjust accumulation of power that it enables. So after several years of not conducting and lawsuits and disgrace, Levine announced a comeback in the summer of 2020. He was engaged by the Maggio Musicale Fiorentino in Florence to conduct, get this, Hugh, a Berlioz opera called The Damnation of Faust.
Subtle.
Which did happen to have been a specialty of his, but it is very on the nose. The lead conductor of the Maggio Musicale, Zubin Mehta, was apparently supportive. Its director, Alexander Pereira, told Musical America, quote, "I always try to protect people that are demonized. Rightly or wrongly, that's how I am. Levine has been silent for such a long time after contributing so much to music, and I think that the musical world needs to hear him. We worked hard with Levine's agent to convince him, but I think that what ultimately swayed his decision is that he is missing music making so much," end quote.
Rightly or wrongly is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence. Rightly or wrongly, in this case, wrongly.
Yeah, truly. However, his scheduled comeback was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And a few weeks later, on March 9th, 2021, James Levine died at his home in Palm Springs, California. His death was not announced to the press for more than a week, and obituaries noted that he was survived by his wife, Sue Thompson.
Ah, so they were married.
At the end, yeah, they got married at the end.
You're listening to Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history. And we'd just like to take a moment to thank all our supporters over on Patreon.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible without you. And that's why we now have, for Patreon supporters and Apple Podcast subscribers, a new monthly podcast called Extra Bad Gays. And that's where we have more informal but still informed conversations about hot topics, current issues, current events, current culture. But we do it with that same analysis that makes the show. So this last month, we just talked about this new gay Fire Island nightmare community that they want to build in the Mediterranean. But it ended up becoming a much deeper conversation about the history of gentrification, about gay men's complicity in it, about how it affects queer communities. And that's the kind of analysis you can expect from the show, along with, episodes about Diva Down George Santos and our favorite and least favorite gay Christmas movies.
And if you still feel like you haven't had your fill of Bad Gays, why not check out our book, which is available now, Bad Gays, A Homosexual History, in hardback or paperback. And it's also now available in Italian translation and coming soon in Thai and in Spanish.
And that's at badgayspod.com/book. And our Patreon is patreon.com/badgayspod, or click subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Back to the show.
Well, thanks, Ben, for that difficult and sadly, like, all too familiar story. It really brought to mind sort of other major cases recently, most obviously, of course, I think probably being Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, I mean, Harvey Weinstein is one of these cases where, you know, it threatens to obliterate everything else, given the, you know, vast sort of industrial horrifying scale of the harassment there. But yeah, there are some similarities. I think we should reiterate, there was never a court case here, right? Like, because of statutes of limitations, because in that one case, the age of consent was still 16. What we're discussing here are allegations and the results of the Met's internal investigation, and that was released to the public as part of the back-and-forth court case between Levine and the Met after he was fired. So he charged that he was fired wrongly, and the Met entered then their internal investigation into the court record of that lawsuit in order to make its case. So that's what we're basing this off of, and that's what we know. We're talking about allegations. They're allegations that I find, like, credible. But yeah,
I guess going back to that question or that issue you mentioned earlier about, like, what we, this difficulty that people have because they there's art that is meaningful to them that's produced is made in some way by these people who've done bad things, and people, you know, either want to totally separate it or they think it can't be separated at all, like. And I guess, do you think actually it was the quality of the work that he was making that allowed him to continue doing that? Or do you think it was that he just got into the quality of his art got him into a position of power that he could then abuse? Like, do you really think it's the art that means people can't let it slide and close their eyes to it? Because the same thing, for example, happened in the UK, but with Jimmy Savile, who is, by no one's metric, an artist of any meaning or importance. But he got himself into a position of power where to tackle him would be too much. And then there's a similar issue of, like, everyone knew the rumors. Like,
yeah, I think here it's a power thing, right? You know, and Levine accumulated his power in several ways. One of the ways he accumulated his power was by being, like, a great artist, you know, and someone who was, in addition to being a great conductor, also extremely good at working with singers, also extremely good at planning seasons, also extremely good at, you know, building orchestras slowly over time. Then I think you end up where the power is what actually enables it to happen. And I think it's important. There were some conversations after this happened after this came to light, where a lot of people responded by saying that they sort of always had hated Levine. They always knew he was trash. They always knew he was awful. And I think that's too easy. Like, I'm not going to tell anyone that they should not have this in their head, or hold them down and force them to listen to a James Levine recording. Like, that would be stupid. I have no interest in forcing anyone to listen to anything. But I think it's too easy to say that everyone who ended up being this kind of real monster was such a horrible artist and such a horrible person the whole time that we all just sort of knew, right? Like, that then lets us off the hook. And that then means that we're not prepared to think about what happens when someone that we do like and respect turns out to be abusing their power and turns out to be abusing other people.
Yeah, right, because it's pretending to be a critical claim, but actually it's just an inversion of the opposite argument, which is that he can't have done this because he made great art.
Exactly.
And therefore you're saying that isn't a value judgment that makes sense. I never liked it, so he
exactly.
He's guilty.
And so
I always liked it, so he can't be guilty. And the point is that, like, the people who we do like, we should always still have an eye to the potential that they can be bad people.
Right. I mean, there was a really there was a moment when he died when people were having a little too much fun on classical music Twitter with some people who had worked with him who chose on his death to focus on their memories of working with him and, you know, sort of how important he'd been to their career and whatever. And, you know, I think, like, no one should ever think about James Levine without thinking about these allegations of abuse. That's part of the story. You should also, I think, be able to hold in your head the idea that someone can have been a truly great musician and also have done this, which is not about excusing the behavior. It's about understanding the fact that people are capable of doing both extraordinary and horrifying things in the same lifespan, in the same day. And if we get into a place of thinking that only kind of cartoonishly bad people who have no other kinds of qualities are capable of doing really evil stuff, then I think we're not able to see and appreciate and understand evil when it happens. There were a bunch of people who, I mean, there were some very sort of cringy articles where people were reflecting on what they were going to do with their collections of James Levine recordings, right? Which is really not the point. There's one opera website called Parterre Box, which would start when the Met was broadcasting an old performance on the radio or on the internet during COVID when they were closed. They did a televised performance every day for free. And when Levine was conducting, they would just mark it as J_L_, so as to not like you say his name. And there were some like classical music DJs that said they were no longer going to play his recordings, and some people said that they didn't want to listen to the recordings. And I mean, I have no interest in forcing anyone to listen to the recordings. What I'll say is that, A, this is an extremely collaborative art form, right? So if we decide that we're no longer going to listen to James Levine recordings, then we're also taking a lot of people who did not do anything wrong, and their extremely hard and dedicated work, which is, and their talent and their brilliance and their skill, which is also contained in these documents, and that's also being silenced. And I also think that, yeah, it's too easy. I think every time someone sees James Levine conducting on a CD cover, they should reflect on the systems of power that enabled this to go on for so long, and where in our world now are there accumulations of power like this that are enabling people?
Okay, so Ben, do you think... I mean, I think I know the answer.
Bad gay. Yeah.
So if people would like to know more about both, like, about James Levine and the allegations against him and the reporting of it, what are some of the sources you use for this episode?
Well, this episode was primarily based on two articles written for Van Music Magazine by an extremely disreputable person named Ben Miller. Those two articles are both linked in the show notes. So when the story broke, obviously I'd been hearing these rumors for years. I was listening to the Verdi Requiem on the Met broadcast before going out to meet friends in Berlin. I hear the end of the Verdi Requiem. I go out to meet friends. On the fucking subway, I pull my phone out and I open the art section of the Times and I see allegations of sexual abuse, James Levine. And you understand, like, if you had been hearing these rumors for years, I mean, it was like,
yeah,
oh, I finally got it. So, like, I immediately start texting people and going back and forth. And I wrote an email to my editor, a drunken email to my editor at Van Magazine, I think at like 1 o'clock in the morning, basically saying in all caps, like, James Levine story broke. I heard rumors when 12, must write essay now, please, please. And then the next day he told me yes. And so that's where the first article, Silence Breaking, came from. And then I wrote a follow-up later about the kind of back and forth based on the court documents. And then there's a whole bunch of articles, which to go through them all would be way too detailed. But I want to shout out the Boston Globe article that did really detailed reporting on the Levineites, on the cult at the Cleveland Institute of Music. And also the Times reporting on the court cases and on the additional allegations after Ashok Pai, and also, of course, the New York Post for breaking the story in the first place in December of 2017. And all those links are in the show notes.
Well, thank you very much. My name's Hugh Lemmy. If you want to find me online, you can subscribe to my newsletter, hugh.substack.com.
And I am on the internet everywhere at Ben Writes Things and at benwritesthings.com. Until later. Bye.
Bye.
Bad.